Now that the Iowa caucuses are in the books, the focus of the presidential race is on New Hampshire. In this edition of the Week in Review, our guests will react to Ted Cruz's and Hillary Clinton's victories in Iowa, and we'll discuss who's poised to finish strong in next week's New Hampshire primaries. Plus, we'll talk some about the highlights of last night's Democratic debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Besides discussing the latest issue in the race for president during this edition of the Week in Review, we will talk about other top stories in politics, in state and national politics, and we will welcome your input, too. What would you like to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Rick Essenberg is a president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a blogger at Shark and Shepherd blogspot.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Ed Filone is with us, an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
Good to have you both with us. We will start with Iowa and the presidential race. The long anticipated Iowa caucuses were on Monday. Ted Cruz won the prize on the Republican side, and we'll get to that in a moment. But let's look at the Democrats race first. Hillary Clinton barely defeated Bernie Sanders in Iowa. Ed Filone, what did you take away from that particular contest?
Well, I think that people are starting to realize that all of the theatrics on the Republican side and the breaking down of the traditional Republican coalition has masked the fact that on the Democratic side there's also some deep divisions in the party, and that has now come out. I think it's not so much a pro-Bernie Sanders surge as it is a desire for a choice on the Democratic side, and some debate over tactics. I think Bernie and Hillary share the same objectives and the same values on the Democratic side. It's really a debate over tactics, the best way to achieve those. And so I'm not surprised. Iowa's a very white state as far as the electorate. That helps Bernie, hurts Hillary, because a lot of her support is in the minority side. And it's a very highly college-educated, very liberal state, and that helps Bernie as well. I think going forward, this will be healthy for the Democratic Party to work out this debate.
What is your reaction, Rick, to Hillary Clinton's barely edging out Sanders in Iowa?
You know, I'm not sure it's as unique as we think it is. I mean, I think that in both parties, there is a base, which is either on the Republican side to the right of where the party is generally, on the Democratic side is to the left of where the party is generally. And sometimes in primaries, particularly in states like Iowa and New Hampshire, that base can exert an outsized influence. And, you know, we've seen it before on the Democratic side, you know, with candidates like Jesse Jackson. We've seen it on the Republican side. I think this was an opportunity for, you know, the Democratic base in Iowa to sort of express their I don't think it's about tactics. I think it's about fundamental disagreement with Hillary Clinton. They think she's to the right. They're frustrated. They thought they had moved the party significantly to the left with Barack Obama, and to some extent they did, but perhaps not as much as they thought they had. And I think it's an opportunity for them to vent their frustration. It's hard for me to see a path to the nomination for Bernie Sanders, but you know, maybe this is, you know, that rare year that is not like every other year, and we'll see things that we haven't seen before.
Yeah. Martin O'Malley suspended his presidential campaign shortly after the Iowa results came in, which meant that last night's Democratic debate featured Sanders and Clinton one-on-one for the first time. They had a couple of heated exchanges, but they also shared a moment of unity. Let's take a listen to this clip from last night's debate.
Would you unite the party by trying to pick Senator Sanders as your running mate?
Well, I'm certainly going to unite the party, but I'm not getting ahead of myself. I think that would be a little bit presumptuous. If I'm so fortunate as to be the nominee, first person I will call to talk to about where we go and how we get it done will be Senator Sanders.
Senator, would you consider the secretary?
I agree with what the secretary said. We shouldn't be getting ahead of ourselves. And as I have said many times, you know, sometimes in these campaigns, things get a little bit out of hand. I happen to respect the secretary very much. I hope it's mutual. On our worst days, I think it is fair to say, we are 100 times better than any Republican candidate.
So, Ed, what did you think about that moment of unity?
Well, I think it underscores what I was saying, which is there's broad agreement between the policy prescriptions of Senator Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And so I think, you know, really what you're seeing, the strength behind Bernie is really a reaction against the inevitability of Hillary's nomination. I think Democrats in general don't like to be told that they have to do anything in all walks of their life, and I think that includes they don't like being told who they have to support. And so I think it's natural they'll resist the coronation, if you will. But I think ultimately Hillary will be the nominee, and I think the party will unify because the two sides do really share desire in terms of foreign policy, in terms of health care, in terms of the economy and job creation. There's not a lot of daylight between Senator Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Yep. Do you see the Hillary Clinton emerging victorious, Rick Essenberg?
Well, I think as I said before, I do. I also don't believe for a moment that the first person that Hillary Clinton will call will be Bernie Sanders. I think that's the type of thing that politicians say. And again, I think that there are some substantial differences. I'm fairly certain that Hillary Clinton is not going to campaign for the presidency in the fall on the platform of, you know, substantial increases in taxes on the middle class, which, you know, is what you'd have to do if you wanted to put Bernie Sanders platform into place. She's not going to run as a socialist. You know, her husband was well known for triangulation. He was well known for saying that the era of big government is over, and I think a lot of Democrats remember that. They don't much like it, and that's why they're supporting Sanders.
Let's take a call from Freddie in West Allis. Hi, Freddie.
Hi. I'm a Bernie supporter. I think that Hillary Clinton is a one percenter. I think she represents the old guard. I think she's a corporatist. She takes money and does for Goldman Sachs and other crooks like that. And I think she's going to be the nominee for president. But what my question is how is she going to address the farther left wing of the Democratic Party's concerns? Because as an angry voter and as a college-educated working-class American, I stand to gain the least from either ticket, the Republicans or the Democrats. Unless she does something to address Bernie Sanders' issues as far as this 1% thing and oligarchy developing the United States, I will not vote for her, even if it means the Republican candidate wins the presidency.
Yeah,
so she stands a real danger of isolating the far-left vote.
All right. What do you have to say to that, Ed Falone, first?
Well, I think, I'd be interested to know the caller's opinion of President Obama and his presidency, because I think many people on the far left of the Democratic Party have been frustrated with President Obama for essentially trying to be a centrist, trying to take half measures and incremental progress towards Democratic policy goals. And I think the expectation would be that Hillary would be more of the same. And I don't understand, and I'm just respectfully disagreeing with the caller, I don't understand the vilification of Hillary for essentially campaigning to continue the Obama incremental approach rather than trying to do a scorched earth, let's, you know, change everything approach, which is what we're getting from the far right on the Republican side. So I think that that's a minority view.
Yeah. Do you think that Hillary is going to need to do something to reach out to the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party in order to get their votes, Ed?
I think she will, but I don't think it's going to be through policy prescriptions. For example, I don't think she's going to push for scrapping Obamacare and replacing it with a single-payer system. I think it's going to be through appointments Just in the same way, you know, President Obama reached out to the Hillary supporters by appointing her Secretary of State, I think President Hillary Clinton will reach out to the Bernie supporters by appointing some of his biggest supporters to positions in her administration.
Mm-hmm. You want to comment, Rick?
Well, to some extent, it's an intramural disagreement that I perhaps don't have standing to address. But I do think she's going to have, or at least she has the prospect of having an enthusiasm gap. You know, Barack Obama was successful because, you know, he was able to turn out voters that hadn't turned out before. And I'm not sure that she can do that. I think that, you know, the problem that the Secretary of State Clinton has is she's got a lot of Democrats who like her, but they don't love her. And they don't trust her. And she lacks the political skills that her husband had. And I think it's going to be tough sledding. And I'm not sure that there's any policy prescription that she could make that would address this. But you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Ed, do you agree with the caller's assessment that Hillary Clinton is a one percenter?
Well, I mean, I think that what she is clearly a politician with a long history of service in the U.S. Senate as First Lady, as Secretary of State. And that requires, I mean, to really be an effective politician, it requires working with the existing power structure in this country. You know, I think we see, and when we talk about the Republican side, this will become evident, you know, the naivete of people who think you can win office and change the world by just forcing people to agree with you and abandon all of their own feelings and objectives. So I think that to be an effective politician, you have to work within an existing power structure, not tear everything down. And I think that's probably what we want for president, is someone who's effective, who can do things. So I don't consider her a one percenter. I consider her to be a pragmatist and someone who has accomplished a lot in her career.
I think that, you know, when you get paid $675,000 for a speech, you're not a one percenter, you're a tenth of a one percenter.
You know, that came up as a very sharp exchange over speaking fees or taking money from Wall Street banks, one of the moments of disagreement in last night's debate. Hillary Clinton made it clear that she is not being bought and paid for, that accepting speaking fees and contributions from the banks doesn't mean she's changing her positions on anything. Rick, about that?
Well, I'm not one who is devoted to the notion that, you know, you can follow the money and because somebody contributes money to a politician, the politicians are necessarily sort of changing their point of view to match those of their donors. I mean, I think that, you know, in my experience, donors tend to want to buy a sure thing, so they look for somebody who actually shares the views that they have rather than give somebody money in the hope that they'll change them. But on the other hand, I mean, I think it's natural that one would raise questions about paying that much money for a speech to a politician, because it is unlikely. And, you know, I'm sure that the Secretary of State has a lot of insights and wonderful stories to tell. I'm also fairly certain, given the fact that she's still an active politician, that she's not telling them. And the notion that somehow this speech is so good and so wonderful that it's worth $675,000 strikes me as implausible, and I think it's reasonable for people to think, well, you know, what else is going on? She says she hasn't changed any of her positions. I certainly can't point to any that she has changed, and so I take her word for it. But it you know, it's uncomfortable, particularly if at the same time your political platform is sort of based upon stoking envy against rich people. It sort of lies ill in your mouth to make that claim when, you know, you're sort of, you know, dining so heavily at the trough. Yeah.
Before we have Ed respond, let me take a call from Maddie in Wapaka. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I agree with Bernie Sanders when he said that even on their worst days, that both he and Hillary are better than the Republicans for the average American. And the most important thing that's coming up is appointments to the Supreme Court. But, you know, it seems like all the commentators and news media seem to, like, crown Hillary. I think I'm hoping that Bernie wins because he is for breaking up the big banks. And anybody that saw the movie The Big Short or read that book knows why that's important.
All right. Thank you, Maddie. That's what I thought Maddie was going to say first off, is that there is a big difference between Clinton and Sanders in that Sanders wants to break up the big banks and Clinton does not, Ed Falone.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rick would like to stir up the pot and get the Democrats, I don't know, taking a position against capitalism or somehow saying it's morally suspect to make money, which would be sort of the inverse of the Mitt Romney debacle from last time around. You know, it's really not a question of, you know, should we blame Hillary Clinton for charging speaking fees? I can recall William Bennett, Secretary of Education under Reagan, coming to Marquette Law School and charging an outrageous speaking fee. You know, he was Mr. Values, right? Writing books about values and morality, and it was outrageous what he was charging to speak. I think it's not about capitalism or greed. I think it's about having a government that is on the side of the population against business in the sense of regulating and overseeing business, not eliminating capitalism, not breaking up banks, but rather having effective oversight so they can do their job, they can make their profit, but at the same time not engage in practices that put the rest of us at financial risk. And I think that you know, Hillary is solidly on that side.
We need to take our break, and when we come back from the break, we will take a look at the Republican side of the presidential ticket, and we will welcome more of your input on the news of the week. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Ed Falone, an associate professor of law at Marquette University, and Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top stories in state and national politics. And we are welcoming your input, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Today we are talking with Rick Essenberg and Ed Falone. We talked about the Democratic presidential race, so we should talk about the Republican side as well. Ted Cruz defeated a crowded GOP field in Iowa on Monday. Donald Trump came in second, just squeaking by Marco Rubio, who came in a strong third. Trump had been leading most polls heading into Iowa. So, Rick, why do you think Cruz won?
You know, I think that Americans have a healthy distrust of politicians, and they flirt from time to time with this idea that there could be something in someone who's entirely different. And, you know, I mentioned Jesse Jackson before. That was an example. You know, H. Ross Perot. There have been, you know, people who have sort of tempted the public, but at the end, that type of populist appeal tends to wane. And I'm not sure whether the Trump phenomenon has run its course, but I certainly hope that it has. I think that what you saw is the Iowa voters were coming back down to earth. I think Cruz won because evangelical voters were some incredible percentage of the turnout in Iowa, and he had a strong appeal to those voters. I think that the as the election came nearer, and you know, people had to sort of assess whether or not they actually wanted to vote for Donald Trump as opposed to, you know, sort of say that they were supporting him as a way of sort of sticking their thumb in the eye of the so-called establishment. they started to think again. And I, my guess is that you're going to see, Trump's support rather steadily eroding over time, and eventually this becomes a race between Cruz and Rubio.
Yeah. So what do you think, Ed?
Well, I think that if you look at the last two Republican campaigns on the presidential race, you had early on the establishment, the Republican establishment, coalesce around a presumptive nominee, and you had conservatives representing the evangelical, the Tea Party, the more extreme right, splitting among multiple candidates and unable to prevent Mitt Romney or John McCain from getting the nomination. This time around, you've got the reverse. You've got too many establishment candidates splitting the vote, and you've got Cruz and, to a lesser extent, Trump going after and monopolizing the evangelical, Tea Party, and extreme right. Trump doesn't quite tap into it in a pure vein because he's also appealing to independents, people who have been outside politics and are getting excited about the novelty of him. But Cruz definitely is focused like a laser on that core, and he's established himself as the one who has that part of the party. Iowa was perfect for him in terms of population, heavily evangelical, heavily extreme right in terms of the Republican Party voter. So it was tailor-made for him. Trump made a lot of noise about winning, but ultimately, it came down to feet on the ground, turnout, doing the spade work to have a machine in place in the caucuses, and a few dirty tricks by Cruz.
Well, after a gracious concession speech after his second place finish, Trump now is calling for a do-over in Iowa, saying that Ted Cruz stole the election. Cruz was accused by Ben Carson of spreading a false rumor that Carson was dropping out of the race, and Cruz's campaign telling his supporters that that they should vote for Cruz. Cruz apologized for his campaign's actions along these lines. What do you think, Ed Falone? I mean, should Ted Cruz's victory be nullified, or should there be a do-over over this?
Well, I for one would vote against having to endure the Iowa caucuses again. But no, I don't think there's any do-over or penalty. But I think the danger here for Cruz is that certain narratives develop about candidates, and those narratives become solidified in the mind of voters if, in fact, there are facts that surface that support that narrative. And the narrative about Ted Cruz has been: everyone hates him, you can't trust him, he's out for himself. He'll lie, he'll cheat, he'll do whatever it takes for him to succeed. And it's been noted that no one likes him. And here we see his campaign engaging in these sort of Nixonian dirty tricks. And it reinforces the narrative that Cruz really will do anything if he thinks it will advance his interests. And that's not healthy for him going forward to reinforce that narrative.
Dirty tricks, Rick?
Well, first of all, I'm not a Cruz supporter, but the facts do matter. And what happened here is that the Carson campaign did put out a rather ill-advised statement that he was going to go home to Florida after the election. CNN then tweeted that out. And then on the air, CNN reporters overinterpreted that statement as suggesting that Carson may be suspending his campaign. Cruz's campaign then tweeted out what CNN had reported. I don't know that that's a dirty trick. It seems to me that any campaign would have done that. Carson's campaign then was incredibly slow to put out a statement that wasn't true. I think you can criticize the Cruz campaign for, being too quick to go with news that they wanted to believe. You can criticize the Cruz campaign for not going to greater lengths to check it out. But I'm not sure that in that they were much different than what any other political campaign would do. So I think calling it a dirty trick or describing it as the Cruz campaign spreading a false rumor is just inaccurate. I mean, that's not the way the thing happened. I do think that Cruz has got an image problem that he's got to deal with. He's got to push back in some way on the notion that he's difficult to get along with. But I think that description of what happened is simply goes too far.
Well, and there was another. Go ahead, Ed.
I was going to say, what about the fake voter report cards the Cruz campaign sent out?
These are like the fake voter report cards that I've gotten in my home, I don't know how many times over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, that's become a fairly common campaign tactic on both the Democratic and Republican side to send out, these notices which are preying on or sort of predicated on political science research that shows you can shame voters into voting by suggesting to them that somebody is watching this. I don't particularly care for it. I wouldn't want to do it if I was a candidate. But once again, Ted Cruz didn't invent the tactic because I know I've gotten all sorts of communications like that in my house over the years from candidates from a variety of different campaigns.
Let's also talk about Marco Rubio having his stronger than expected third place finish, and now he's heading into New Hampshire with some momentum. On Wednesday, Rubio criticized President Obama's speech at a mosque, saying Obama's rhetoric is pitting people against each other. Obama had criticized Republicans for using anti-Muslim rhetoric. Rick, let's go to you first on this. What do you make of Rubio's third place finish, and then we'll talk about the Muslim issue.
Yeah, I was surprised. I didn't think he'd do that well. I think, on the one hand, I think that Rubio has a tremendous, tremendously high ceiling. I think one of the challenges for conservatives and libertarians is they want to portray and sell their philosophy to people who might not already share it. And, one of the ways you do that is in a sort of forward-looking and optimistic way, and Rubio is very, very good at that. I think that's one reason why, in my view, he'd be a better general election candidate than Cruz, and I was surprised that he did as well as he did in Iowa, and I think it bodes well for his campaign. With respect to the his criticism of President Obama's speech at the mosque, it's not that he's speaking at a mosque. It's that he's speaking at a mosque essentially to sort of raise the specter of this sort of widespread anti-Muslim backlash and try to make a political issue of it. It's not that he spoke there. It's what he said. And that's not... that's not unusual for President Obama. President Obama likes to divide people. He likes to draw this line that places himself as a reasonable person on one side of the line and everybody else as either unreasonable or motivated by bad faith or playing politics on the other. And I think Rubio was calling him to task on that.
Ed?
Well, I think, I want to first amplify one of the things Rick said. I think really looking at both Donald Trump and Marco Rubio, there really is this audition process. The Republican primaries for president has become an auditioning for spokesperson role. Who shall we hire to be the mouthpiece? And what that person actually believes or has done is sort of irrelevant, as you can see by how quickly they abandon policy positions and reverse course. What matters is who's going to be telegenic and appealing to low-information voters who are just going to catch a snippet on TV and say, oh, that looks like a nice person. And Trump understood this. He understood that this was an auditioning process, and that's how he was able to hijack the primary process for the last year, really, is he was playing the role of spokesperson and an entertainer, and he understood that was the process. Now everyone is frantically looking for the alternative. Everyone within the party is looking for the alternative to Trump, although they did indicate they thought they could live with him as a spokesperson. And Marco Rubio is the obvious choice. He's young, telegenic. He's got a Hispanic last name, although Hispanics don't like him. Again, he's very thin on experience and policy proposals. And I'm not sure he's really up to the task. And I think this criticism of President Obama for going to the mosque is a real demonstration. He's trying to say anything, say what's expected of him. And ultimately, it comes down to criticizing the president for going to a group of American citizens and lawful permanent residents, a community that's been suffering prejudice and discrimination and hatred, and saying he stands in solidarity with that group. And I think that's in the finest American tradition, to stand with people who are facing discrimination, and to criticize him for that, I think, is, morally bankrupt.
Ed, why do you say Hispanics don't like Rubio?
Well, I mean, certainly Mexicans, Puerto Ricans. There's this odd assumption on the side of the Republican Party that all Hispanics are the same and Cubans are as good as Mexicans or equivalent to Mexicans. Well, Mexicans, of course, we have a large undocumented population in the U.S. of Mexicans who are very resentful of the fact that all it takes is for a Cuban to set foot on U.S. soil and they automatically get lawful residence. It's a huge disparity in treatment. And there's a lot of resentment, a lot of families that are suffering, and they look at the Cubans as sort of the group that gets special treatment. And so I would never assume that a Cuban can attract a large segment of the Hispanic vote.
Yeah. Rick, back to you. You said a couple of times you're not a Ted Cruz fan, and you're happy to see Trump falling from his ascension. Are you endorsing or backing formally Rubio?
I'm sure the campaign is waiting with bated breath to find out whether I do that or not. I'm inclined to support Rubio. My view has always been that I thought that virtually everybody who was running on the Republican side would be a fine candidate, with the exception of Donald Trump. And the reason that I thought that Donald Trump would be a poor candidate is I think that the conservative libertarian party in the United States should probably nominate somebody who's conservative or libertarian, and Trump's not. I spend most of my time in and around the vast right-wing conspiracy, and everybody I know can't stand Donald Trump, and they can't stand him because he doesn't believe in anything that they believe in. And I think that it's very, very difficult at the end of the day, when people start to take a closer look, for, somebody who holds those views to win the party's nomination.
Who's going to win New Hampshire on both sides, first Rick and then Ed?
If you look at the polls, it's hard to see the Trump support could erode that quickly. I think he'll hang on. I think he'll win. I don't think he'll win by as much as the polls seem to suggest that he will win. On the Democratic side, I think it's going to be much the same. I think that Sanders will win, but what was the last poll showed him ahead by 29 points. Mm-hmm. He's not going to win by 29 points.
What do you think, Ed, in terms of the victors in New Hampshire?
Well, you have to look at the electorate as being reflective of a particular state and not reflective of the nation as a whole. I think that's why you saw the results you saw in Iowa, and I think it's similar in New Hampshire. I think, Bernie Sanders is a senator from a neighboring state. He's got very high name recognition. People like him. He's a crusty northerner, and they like crusty northerners. I think he'll win. I think the real story coming out is probably going to be that Hillary will do better than expected, and I think that'll be the story, kind of like her husband's comeback kid effort. And on the Republican side, I think it will be close. I think Trump will drop Significantly, part of his appeal was his aura of invincibility. Take that away, and he's not quite as attractive. I think the real question will be, do Chris Christie and Jeb Bush succeed in halting Marco Rubio's rise? And I think that's where most of the stories will be after the primary, is who's going to be that, you know, third candidate that's going to become part of the trio that moves ahead with Cruz and Trump.
All right. We will, when we come back from break, we'll talk about some more political news, including Congressman Reid Ribble saying he's not going to seek re-election. We'll talk about some of the news issues making news in the state Supreme Court justice race here in Wisconsin and some other stories in state politics. And we will welcome your input on these state political issues at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review, talking this week with Ed Filone, an associate professor of law at Marquette University, and Rick Essenberg, a president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking this week with Rick Essenberg and Ed Filone about the top stories in the news, including state news. Let's turn our attention to the 8th Congressional District. Republican Congressman Reid Ribble of the 8th Congressional District in northeastern Wisconsin announced on the weekend that he would not be seeking another term in Washington. He said that that he wanted to spend more time with his family. It's pretty much the only swing district in the state. At least it's been represented by Democrats and Republicans in recent years. Ed, do you think Democrats can gain control of that congressional seat?
Well, it is a swing seat, and I think it will be hard fought. And yeah, I think Democrats could gain control of that seat. I think it's interesting. Reid Ribble was elected in 2010, part of that incoming class of sort of Tea Party Republicans in the first midterm election after Obama was elected. And about half of that incoming class is now either out of Congress or announced that they won't run for re-election. So I think it reflects people who went to Washington thinking it would all be very easy and finding that the hard work of governing is actually hard. And they're getting disillusioned and dropping out of Congress because their radical change is not as easy to implement as they thought.
Yeah, he said that he would limit himself to four terms, but he's only finishing up number three. Rick, why do you think he's bowing out?
I have no reason to think it's any reason other than what he says. I mean, it's hard to get things done in Congress. That's true. He's a citizen politician, and sometimes citizen politicians come to the conclusion that they spent enough time in government and they want to go back to public life. It's something that we would have accepted as normal in the past, but now we sort of have this view that once you somehow get power, you must hang on to it at all costs, and if you don't, there's something wrong with you. And I think that's not the case, and so I wish him well. I think the district will be competitive. I think it leans Republican. I think the Republicans will probably hang on to it, but it'll all depend on the candidates in the campaign.
Well, let's talk about another election issue. You are both legal experts, so let's get your thoughts on the state Supreme Court race. An outside group has posted an online campaign ad that is using footage that was prepared by Justice Rebecca Bradley, raising some questions about whether she broke her pledge to not coordinate with such groups. The Bradley campaign said the footage is public domain and has no problem with independent groups using it. She is facing Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Joe Donald and Appeals Court Judge Joanne Kloppenburg in the February 16th primary. Rick, what's your read on this race and this particular controversy?
Well, I think controversy is a non-issue. She put the footage out into the public domain just as a candidate puts out their position papers and other materials, and people are free to use them, and that doesn't meet the legal definition of coordination. One of the things about this race that I find sort of amusing, and I think it is going to come down to Kloppenburg versus Bradley, is this sort of critique of Bradley as somehow sort of being politically motivated. When you have, you know, Joanne Kloppenburg's campaign was the most politicized Supreme Court race in our history. It became a referendum on Scott Walker in Act 10 with overt appeals to vote for Joanne Kloppenburg so that we would have the fourth vote to overrule Act 10. And the notion that people from that camp would somehow criticize Rebecca Bradley for running a politicized campaign and being a political and not a, a judicial figure is just a tad ironic.
Mm-hmm. Ed?
Well, I think it's not a legal issue in terms of campaign finance law, but I do think it is an issue of how Justice Bradley has represented she's going to run her campaign and how she, in fact, is doing it. You know, in political races for Senate, House of Representatives, we all know how the game is played. The candidate throws up on YouTube or puts on Dropbox some video, what's called B-roll, of them walking and talking to people, sitting at their desk looking studious. And they know that the reason they do that is so that it's out there, because groups that want to run ads to support that candidate need footage of the candidate. And so it's thrown out there for them. And that's the way politics is done. But judges are not politicians, as John Roberts said in some Supreme Court decision last term. And I think the Bradley campaign has tried to say that she's not a politician and that she is engaging in the tactics of politicians, in the same way in asking the Republican Party, or not asking, but in accepting the Republican Party, circulating nomination petitions on her behalf. I ran for the Supreme Court. I ran for this office, and when I ran, I had my campaign manager call the Democratic Party and tell them to stop doing some things they were doing, because it was my campaign, and I was not running as a politician. And I'm disappointed, quite frankly, that Justice Bradley is not doing more to take control of how our campaign is run.
By the way, we will be hosting candidate forums with all of the candidates running for state Supreme Court justice Monday, this coming Monday at 7:30. We will have Joanne Kloppenburg with us. Tuesday at 7, we will have Justice Bradley with us, and then Tuesday at 7:30, we will have Judge Joe Donald with us. So candidate forums for state Supreme Court justice Monday and Tuesday here on the Ideas Network. And again, the primary week after next, February 16th. Other news, a state Senate committee passed a bill that would prohibit towns and counties from issuing photo IDs or spending money on them. This now goes to the full Senate. The bill's authors say the plan would prevent fraud and confusion. Critics say it's anti-immigrant and that it's aimed at a recent Milwaukee plan to issue local IDs to those who are having trouble getting government-issued IDs. Ed, how do you feel about local IDs and the effort to prohibit them?
First, full disclosure, I'm on the board of Voces de la Frontera Acción, which is one of the groups that was supporting this. You know, this is an issue that's very important in the immigrant community. New York City, some other cities on the East Coast have done this. Undocumented people have sometimes been called walking ATMs, because they can't open bank accounts without an ID, and they're known for carrying around large amounts of cash and are subject to crime. They also often can't get prescription drugs, because certain drugs you can't get without showing a photo ID. And also people in the transgender community who have dealings with law enforcement would like to have an ID that reflects their gender identity rather than their birth identity. And so there are a lot of people out there who would like this ID, that the driver's license is not an option, and it would actually make their life better. And it goes against the supposed core concept of local control, which Republicans keep telling me is so important to preserve, to have the city of Milwaukee denied providing this service to residents that need it.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on this, Rick?
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't think that the bill would prevent the city of Milwaukee from doing it. I think that the bill was addressing county and towns who are actually extensions of the state and don't have home rule rights. But beyond that, my understanding, you can get an ID free from the state of Wisconsin, and presumably this is for people who for some reason don't want to get an ID from the state of Wisconsin or can't get an ID from the state of Wisconsin. My understanding is that this controversy arose because the county would not put on these IDs information that they were not valid for purposes of claiming or voting or claiming state benefits. I don't understand why you wouldn't do that. In fact, the IDs wouldn't be valid for those purposes. It seems to me perfectly legitimate for the state to be concerned about the confusion that could be created by creating local identification cards that people might reasonably assume can be used for something that they can't be used for. And I don't understand if the purpose is, as it has been portrayed by the advocacy groups, why they would resist putting that information on the card themselves. But apparently they have, and that's why we have the controversy.
Almost out of time. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has introduced a bill that would bar county executives from serving in the state legislature at the same time that they're county executives. The bill comes as Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris is getting ready to seek the open Senate seat that is currently held by Republican Mark Gudix. Rick, is this a good proposal by Fitzgerald or what?
Well, I mean, if you assume that county executive is an important job, then I guess it makes some sense that the county executive not hold a state legislative position. But, and, you know, understanding that, you know, a forum like this, I'm supposed to have an opinion about everything, I have to admit that I don't have a very strong opinion about this.
All right. Well, do you have an opinion about this, Ed?
Well, I don't know. I was going to ask Rick if he thought it was a bill of attainder. I mean, this is a law that's being introduced using the system of state government really designed to attack one person's political future. It seems to me that that's endemic of what's the problem in our state, is using government for such narrow partisan ends.
Well, here's a real easy one that both of you maybe have a quick opinion on. Wisconsin school children are advocating that biking be named the state's official exercise. There's a bill in the state legislature to do this now. Should it, Rick?
You know, what I think I would really support is a bill that prohibit, in which legislature disclaimed any intent to ever name anything the official state anything for the, you know, forever. No more official state pastry, no more official state pasta. I think that there are more important things to worry about.
Are you against official things, Ed?
No, actually, whenever I return to Wisconsin from traveling, I'm reminded that we have a reputation for being, shall we say, a somewhat chubby state. And so I think any effort we can to get our residents out there and biking and exercising is probably healthy for all of us.
Well, we'll end on that healthy note as we are out of time. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ed Filone is an associate professor of law at Marquette University Law School, and Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a blogger at sharkandshepherd.blogspot.com. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing and directing this hour. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison for on-air production. Thank you for listening. Coming up on Monday, as mentioned, we will be starting a series of candidate forums with the state Supreme Court justice candidates starting Monday at 7.